Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. That's right, it's Thursday. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians, smart monkeys of all kinds. Good morning to you. Let's have a reading of the Ten Commandments, shall we, Mark Riley?
Which one?
Let's go with the Jewish version.
Oh, the Jewish, Catholic, Protestant,
that's it.
Sanskrit?
I don't have Sanskrit.
Oh, sorry.
Do you have Sanskrit? Lay it out.
I can get it later.
Really? Can we get a Sanskrit version?
Before the show's over.
I am the Lord your God who has taken you out of the land of Egypt. Two. You shall have no other gods besides me. Three. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Four. Remember to keep holy the Sabbath day.
Oh, yeah.
Five, honor your father and mother. Six, you shall not kill. Seven, you shall not commit adultery. Eight, you shall not steal. Nine, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And ten, you shall not covet anything that belongs to your neighbor. Riley, I've broken seven.
I've broken a few. Is that the one about covet thy neighbor's ox and his ass? There's a subheading to that.
These all have subheadings. Some of them have like dozens of subheadings. Some of them are ornate, in elaborate. Some of them refer to slaves. Apparently, there's some subtext you shall not. Which one is it? The Sabbath day. Yeah, there's also some laws that cover. What about the kids of your slaves? If you happen to have a slave that you have sex with, how are those kids treated after you die? What about kids of some other guy's wife? I mean, there are subtext to all these things.
Kids from another guy's wife?
Yes.
Sounds like Jerry Springer, not the Ten Commandments.
Hey, that's what the Jerry Springer is the reason why somebody wrote the Ten Commandments.
Ah,
the Jerry Springer of ancient times. It's like, we got to put a stop to this. This is crazy. It didn't entertain them then, or maybe it did. But the reason I'm talking about this, just on a personal level, I'm no theologian. I'm not even a philosopher or, a psychologist or a psychiatrist or anything like that, a mathematician. I'm none of those things. I'm just a guy that sits and thinks about a number of things. I put them in my head, turn them around, kick them out. But I do know on a personal level, the Ten Commandments have had very little effect on me, in a conscious way. You
know what I mean? Now, what about the adultery? See, now, the adultery one is the most problematic, I think, for most people in this country of all the commandments. There's a lot of coveting, and there may be other things. People don't take that seriously. But remember that people on this planet, even today, can be stoned to death for adultery.
Yeah, well, that's a little crazy.
And of course it's crazy. It's nuts.
There's some people in this country that would like it to be that way here. You know what I mean? They would like it to be that way here. And the truth of the matter is I look at these commandments, Riley, and I got to be honest with you. Whether I knew it or not, first of all, I'm pretty shaky on belief in God in general. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Not a big deal in my life. So that one I've broken. You shall have no other gods besides me. My God shift. Last 3 weeks ago, my God was coffee. A few weeks before that, it was that new, the ice cream with the caramel core. A lot of times, my gods are, TV, movies.
TV, movies?
Sure, cigars were working as a god for me. Anything to fill that hole. But, lately, it's been just, I've been kind of healthy.
Our Lord and Savior have a temple? What's
sure,
going on?
Sure, there's nothing wrong with that. Also, what other things have filled it? Many things fill the false idol hole. We all know that.
Well, it's interesting because we're now looking at the Supreme Court debating the issue of the Ten Commandments in public places, and they're even debating the role that it plays, the role that God and all this plays in the functions of their own court.
Absolutely. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Well, come on. On some level, God sucks, doesn't he?
Oh,
right,
here we
four.
Go. Look, Tim, can you move out of the way, please? Because I'm not sitting near this guy.
Come on, man.
No, come on. No,
hey, if there is one, you got to assume he's got pretty good aim. Remember to keep holy the Sabbath day. Don't do it. I'm working this Saturday night.
Oh.
Honor your father and mother. Why? You
hey,
know what I mean?
Hey,
why? Hey, come on.
Come on, they birthed you.
So what?
They did the deed so you could be here.
No, they didn't. I was a mistake. I was a diaphragm baby. I show the amazing ability to overcome obstacles, even on a spermal level, my friends. I could get, I'm like, that don't bother me. You guys hang out. I'm going over. I am going over. All right? So that one's broken. You shall not kill. Now, I have not done that, I have to admit. I have not had any desire to do it in any real way. right? You shall not commit adultery. Well, that one I screwed up several times.
Most Americans have screwed. Well, let me not, because I haven't done a survey on this. I would say that is the most problematic of the commandments for a lot of Americans.
You shall not steal. Now, I'm trying. I was sitting in the car, you know, coming over here, trying to figure out when did I steal? What did I steal? Honestly, what did I steal?
Does shoplifting count as stealing?
Yes, of course it does.
Okay.
I never shoplifted, but I did steal. I'm gonna make an amends right now. There was this guy Stewart at this camp I went to when I was 14 years old, and you know, he had all these tapes, and I did steal Red Octopus by Jefferson Starship from Stewart, and he kind of knew I stole it, but I stuck by it when he said, "Did you? I know you stole my tape," and I'm like, "No, I didn't." But I stole that tape.
No, that's not your tape sitting in my
exactly.
Double bag. No.
Exactly. And I'm sorry, Stuart, that I stole your tape. I want to make it right. I don't know where Stuart is. He lived in Port Washington at the time. He was my roommate. But I'll get you another tape, okay? Let's see. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. I'm not sure if I've done that, but I think maybe by omission I've done that. What does that mean exactly? Like if someone comes up to me and goes, "Hey, did Riley steal my car?" And if I had no idea whether you did or not, I go, yeah. I'm pretty sure it was Riley.
That's kind of like those things where, you know, where they have accused mass murderers on TV and then they go and interview their next door neighbors. Oh, yeah, I knew all the time he was crazy.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. That's bearing false witness.
You shall not covet anything that belongs to your neighbor. Well, that's certainly that I've definitely broken this morning. I mean, I am Joey Covet. I am the Coveter. That would be my superhero name. The Coveter. The grass is always greener would be my slogan.
What is it? Name one thing that your neighbor has that you want.
Oh, I don't know. Not my neighbor per se.
Oh, okay.
But I mean, people. Sure, okay. Sure. I covet people. Like, you know, I think it'd be a lot easier if I had a lot more money and a house and less things to do. I mean, there's a whole list of people I could name who I'm jealous of. I'm the king of envy, my friend.
Hey, you can envy working this shift. I envy people who can sleep till 10 o'clock. I mean, there's a lot of different things that you could say that you covet, that you can say that you're envying. But the Supreme Court here is being asked to rule whether or not the public display of the Ten Commandments violates the separation between church and state. I have to tell you, Mark, I consider myself, you know, I'm a denominational person. I go to church. But to see the lengths to which some religionists will go to post this, they'll put the Magna Carta next to it. They'll put the Declaration of Independence on top of it. They'll put something else underneath it. They'll try and hide it and mask it and do all kinds of things to make it seem as though it is not a religious tract.
We'll talk about that. Well, they'll seem to make it that their intention is not religious in putting it up there. You
that's
know,
a load.
Right. Well, that Kentucky case where they found that the court in Kentucky was using it as a religious icon, and it was crossing a boundary. And those are the guys who put the Magna Carta up and said, "Well, not now. See the other things up there."
Yeah,
and
well, according
to the other thing? The Magna
Carta, whatever.
Well, you know, the thing with the paper. You know.
Yeah, well, what the Court of Appeals said about that?
The sham!
Yeah.
Well, now, you know, what's interesting is that part of their argument is that the Ten Commandments is the foundation for morality, for American morality, for our legal system.
For the law. All right. Now, if that's the case, then why have most adultery laws, not all, but most adultery laws been wiped from the books?
Right. Well, that's the issue, is that, you know, morality is something that preexisted the Ten Commandments. Morality has been around for as long as human groups have functioned together as groups. You know, morality is something that is fairly innate, but that, you know, is based in sort of rationality and science, and this is something that scares religionists, fanatics, the Christo-fascist zombie brigades of the neocon death cult, and they're not making a great case for themselves and saying that they honor or respect this government by being out on the steps of the Supreme Court, babbling in tongues and dropping to their knees, praying to it as if it had some sort of holy significance. I mean, folks, you know, and then they always make the case that, like, well, Moses is up on the wall in the Supreme Court. Well, so is Hammurabi. So is Solomon. So are many others. And we're going to talk to the cat after this. We are going to talk to constitutional lawyer Erwin Chemerinsky. He's the guy who appeared before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday to advocate for the removal of the Ten Commandments. This is, you know, on the grounds. This is on the grounds of the Texas Capitol.
Yes,
it was originally brought by the case was originally brought up by a homeless lawyer who just couldn't stand looking at the thing.
Yeah,
but we are going to talk. Is that's coming up right now, isn't it?
That is coming up, actually, at 6:30.
So let's get
at the bottom of the hour.
Let's talk about morality when we come back, and we're going to talk about the rest of the people that are on the wall of the Supreme Court, you revisionary, idiot, zombie, death cult people. 16 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Seditious.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Did you know? Twenty past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition. The facts, the fury, the funny. Morning Sedition, don't be stupid. It feels like thinking. We're talking about the Ten Commandments. We're talking about a case that went before the Supreme Court yesterday. We're going to be talking to constitutional lawyer Erwin Chemerinsky, who appeared before the U.S. Supreme Court to advocate for the removal of the Ten Commandments monument from the grounds of the Texas Capitol. He will join us in a little while. You know, talking about morality, talking about the Constitution, talking about the Treaty of Peace and Friendship between the United States and the Bay and subjects of Tripoli of Barbary, you know, citing that the Founding Fathers realized at that time and stated in Article 11, as the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion, as it has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslimmen.
That would be Muslims.
I know, Muslimmen. So there's that. There's also the fact that on some level, the Ten Commandments actually disclaim, in certain ways, a couple of the amendments. Do you understand what I'm saying, Riley? Let me see if I can put it more concisely. That it seems that our government system represents a reaction, okay, a reaction to the principles inherent in the code, in the Ten Commandments. In some cases, a mighty rejection of that code. The First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, for example, is an eloquent repudiation of the First Commandment's prohibition of religious freedom. It is also a repudiation of the Third Commandment's prohibition of freedom of speech. That's an interesting way to look at it, is it not?
It is an interesting way to look at it. In fact, Greg Easterbrook has a suggestion on how to settle this that involves actually getting rid of four of the commandments. As he says, Jesus did actually in the New Testament, that four of them really were not central to biblical teaching. The ones that had to deal with morality and character were the ones, and actually there are six of those. The missing four that they're talking about, and these are, according to Greg Easterbrook, the four that Christ leaves off his inventory. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourself an idol. You shall not make wrongful use of the name of the Lord your God. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. In fact, those four were specifically rejected by Jesus at a point.
Yeah, well, apparently Jesus said, this is from Mark 19:17-19. How do you say that when you see a biblical verse? Chapter 19, verse 17-19.
Yes.
And Jesus said, you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, honor your father and mother. Also, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. So those are just the ones dealing specifically with morality. And there's an argument to be had. Like I said, personally, the commandments have no tremendous impact on how I guided my life. I've made a lot of mistakes in my life. And you know how I learned how not to make those mistakes again, Riley?
How?
Just by doing it. All right? You know, unfortunately, I didn't have to kill somebody to realize that was wrong. But it's not my nature, really, to kill somebody. It's not something I want to do. I am not sociopathic or under some delusional system of thought that would enable me to kill somebody. But, you know, in terms of adultery, in terms of disrespecting my parents, in terms of taking the Lord's name in vain and all that stuff, which, you know, that doesn't even apply. But specifically, there are certain elements of behavior that you find work against you, work against a group of people you love, work against the tribe, as you will. Mm-hmm. And there's arguments that have been made by scientists, by philosophers, that basically say that it's pretty genetic, that morality, for the most part, is something we are predisposed for, that in essence, over eons, groups of people realize that if they behave themselves properly, it benefits the group, which means the group has more kids, which ultimately means the survival of the group throughout the period of history. This has been defined by evolutionary theory, which I know frightens the Christo-fascist zombie brigades. But nonetheless, it has been pretty proven that morality predated Jesus, even predated probably, you know, writing.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's amazing because there seems to be this belief on the part of some people that these sort of public displays of religious symbolism will somehow stop a sociopath from exhibiting that kind of behavior. Now, let's talk about BTK, the alleged BTK killer.
President of the church.
Yeah. Well, I assume he must have known about the commandments.
I would argue. I don't have any proof in this, but I believe, and I'm not just being condescending here, and, you know, I'm certainly, you know, I think that, you know, what Christ said and, you know, the focus of the six commandments that he focused on are pretty reasonable things, and I'm saying that they are innately human things, but I would be willing to bet that most people that kill people on a serial level, pathologically, are, you know, come from or are religious people. I'm going to try and prove that. You know, because I think that a lot of times, if you're not biologically predisposed to psychopathic behavior, that repression, you know, I mean, and this is a Freudian thing, mm-hmm. that, you know, repression and denial and a lot of things that, you know, push down the shadow, push down the ability to really, you know, sort of investigate your darker impulses in a healthy way to get them out or to move through them, you know, probably provoke some bad behavior. And what it's in terms of being before Christ, you know, moral codes that existed before Christ. I mean, you have there are many of them. You have the laws of Urukagina. These are Sumerian laws. 2350 BC. The laws of Ur-Nammu, Sumerian also. This is 40 short paragraphs as a rule. Like things like physical wounds were punished by monetary fines, and more serious crimes such as murder and robbery were punished by death. You have the laws of Lipit-Ishtar, which was also Sumerian. The Sumerians were pretty hip. You have the laws of Ishununa in Babylonia, 1900 BC. And even on the walls of the Supreme Court building, and I was getting into this before, the argument, oh, wow. I guess we're going to have to talk.
We're going to have to take this up after the break.
We are, yeah, but we're also going to have to talk to our guest, constitutional lawyer Erwin Chemerinsky, who actually appeared before the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday to argue this thing, is going to be with us. So stay here.
It's Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Here I am, 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning Sedition.
Yes, it is.
The program that's here on Air America Radio, the network that's taking over the country. Okay, maybe not. Sorry. And I know it's a little early for that behavior, Riley. I apologize.
Don't worry about it. These things take time.
I know. But you know, who comes in today? Ramon with a walker. Like, that's cute. All right? Tom DeLay and his GOP congressional cronies have been stepping up attacks on the AARP for opposing Bush's Social Security plan. So we've got DeLay's Palm Pilot for today. 6:30 a.m. Until Bush's Social Security plan passes, force restaurants to move early bird special back to 10:30 p.m. Make them wait.
Oof.
8 a.m. Steal AARP members' list to make crank calls to them. Tell them if you try to block the president, you'll never see your grandkids again.
God.
10 a.m. Draft new law saying that seniors must pass an eye test, a hearing test, and be able to do 51 arm push-ups before getting prescription drugs. Mean to old people.
Yes.
1 p.m. Relax all safety regulations on wheelchairs. Plus, quietly tell local governments that wheelchair ramps are optional. 3 p.m. Impose a special tax on anyone having more than 4 cats. Boy, I'm under the wire on that one. 6 p.m. Look into banning holiday travel for anyone older than 60 years old. And it's 7:30 p.m. Pay off Wayne Newton to finish every Vegas show with a stirring tribute to Bush's Social Security plan. That's Tom DeLay, of course, the bug-killing dwarf king of the neocon death cult's legislative pig pack. Now, moving into what we were talking about before, which is the Ten Commandment controversy at this point. Yesterday, our guest argued before the Supreme Court for the removal of a Ten Commandments monument from the Texas Capitol grounds. The case was originally filed by Thomas Van Orden, a homeless former lawyer based in Austin. Professor Erwin Chemerinsky is with us. Good morning, Professor.
Good morning. It's nice to talk with you.
Good morning. Are you still buzzed from being in front of the Supreme Court?
It's an amazing experience. I've had it before, and I'm going to do it again in 3 weeks in another case. It's really awe-inspiring. You stand before the justice in a room that's just filled with history.
And also you're standing beneath that famous frieze with the 17 lawmakers of the history of the world there.
Well, that's the key. In that frieze, there's actually 15 different lawmakers, and one of them is Moses. And that's very different than a Ten Commandments monument standing by itself in the Texas State Capitol and the Texas Supreme Court.
Yeah, absolutely. You keep using that frieze as an example of why it should be allowed, but they don't mention that Muhammad, Hammurabi, Solomon, and a number of other people are involved on that frieze as well. Now, what makes that different? What makes this case unique? And who is this guy, Van Orden?
Well, what makes it different than the frieze is there's no doubt that the government can put religious symbols like the Ten Commandments on government property. But it has to do so where it's not conveying a religious message. The frieze on the Supreme Court is obviously about lawgivers through history. The Ten Commandments, the Texas State Capitol, and the Texas Supreme Court are there because Texas wants to convey a religious message. That's what the government can't do. And Thomas Van Orden lives in Austin, Texas, and he simply got tired of walking by the monument every day. And on his own, he filed a lawsuit. He litigated it in the federal district court and the federal court of appeals by himself. And then he called me to ask me to do it in the Supreme Court.
Now, okay.
Well, Erwin Chemerinsky, what do you say to Justice Anthony Kennedy's argument that if an atheist walks by these displays, he can avert his eyes?
Well, by that notion, the government could put a Latin cross on top of the state capitol or crucifix. You don't like it, avert your eyes. And actually, the Supreme Court's precedents are against that. In 1989, the Supreme Court said that a county in Pennsylvania couldn't put a nativity scene in its courthouse by itself. Now, the court could have said people can just avert their eyes, but that's not what the court said. The government cannot endorse religion, even if people might avoid the endorsement by averting their eyes.
And that's right off this First Amendment, which says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, right?
That's exactly right.
Right. Now, let me just ask you this. Like 10 years ago, you know, for me, I'm just a different kind of person. I wouldn't have paid any mind to this. But one of the reasons why this is so important right now is there is an extremist religious movement that wants to completely religify the American government, right?
That's what this case is really about. There are people who would like to see our government be religious rather than secular. The issue isn't really this particular monument. The issue is, are we going to have some form of wall that separates church and state?
Now, Solicitor General Paul Clement is arguing in favor of the monuments on behalf of the Bush administration. I want to run a quote past you and get you to react to it. Solicitor General Clement says, quote, "The Ten Commandments have an undeniable religious significance, but they also have a secular significance as a source of law, a code of the law, and a well-recognized historical symbol of the law." Do you deny that?
Well, no, but the Texas monument emphasizes its religious character, and there's nothing to indicate its secular purpose. The Texas monument has in big letters at the top, "I am the Lord thy God." There's nothing around that indicates it's there for a secular purpose. Also, as I said to the court yesterday, Mr. Clement's statement ignores the social reality. People want the Ten Commandments on the Texas Capitol grounds, not because of its secular significance, but because of its religious message. Roy Moore resigned as Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court. There were demonstrations outside the Supreme Court yesterday. I've gotten dozens of hate messages this week, not because of the secular significance of the Ten Commandments, but because people want a religious message at the state capitol grounds.
Well, they can't be doing, you know, it's the irony of this is if they're trying to make a case for themselves, you know, the last thing they need to be doing is speaking in tongues and kneeling on the court steps.
Well, this, I mean, you know, it really does ignore the social reality to say, oh, the people who were out there protesting were there because they want the secular Ten Commandments.
Right.
It really degrades religion to force them to defend the Ten Commandments as something secular.
Now let's talk about this idea of not so much morality, but you know the foundation of America's laws. You know, certainly cannot be limited, or is it even part of the Ten Commandments, really?
Well, in reality, I don't think it is. If you go back to the debates at the Constitutional Convention, not mm-hmm. once are the Ten Commandments mentioned. In the Federalist Papers, not once are the Ten Commandments mentioned. And there's a reason for that. The framers of our Constitution thought they were children of the Enlightenment, where reason had replaced religion as the basis for decisions. Now, if you look at the Ten Commandments, the first half are religious commandments.
Yeah.
Having no other God, not practicing idolatry, not having graven images, not taking the name of the Lord in vain, observing the Sabbath. That has no relationship to American law.
I really like your tone, by the way. It's a good read. Yeah, absolutely they don't. I want to talk about a little about this sense of morality, too, that they keep attaching to these commandments. As you said, the first four were clearly religious praising of God and respecting God and means of control. And there's only six there that really deal with fundamental morality issues.
Well, there's an interesting point yesterday through our argument where the Attorney General of Texas, Greg Abbott, said that these are really secular. And Justice Ginsburg leaned over and said, have you read them?
I want to hear more about what the justices said. So why don't you tell us a little more about some of the other reactions. Characterize those.
Justice Scalia was obviously openly hostile to my position. I knew from the beginning that he would be. Interestingly, though, he was also hostile when the Attorney General of Texas tried to describe the Ten Commandments as being there for secular historic purposes.
So he's just a hostile guy.
Well, but Justice Scalia said to him, you know, it would be a pyrrhic victory if we said we allow the Ten Commandments to be there because they're secular. The key justice is likely to be Sandra Day O'Connor. And as is so often the case, it was just impossible to read from her questions where she's likely to be. Based on their past votes, I think it's likely that Chief Justice Rehnquist and Justices Scalia and Thomas and perhaps Kennedy will vote to uphold this. But we don't know where Justice O'Connor is, and that's likely to decide the case.
Erwin Chemerinsky, are you... It's almost a given that the Supreme Court is supposed to be insulated to some small extent from American public opinion. But are you at all nervous that these justices might have seen this AP Ipsos poll that says 76% of Americans support the displays of religion like the Ten Commandments?
I think that the court's going to decide on their view of the law. I think that all of these justices have been there a long time. Justice O'Connor's been there since 1981. They know what the public thinks. They obviously care about the public reactions to decisions. But I think what they're also doing is making law for the country in the future. So I'm hopeful, cautiously optimistic, that they're not going to be influenced by those polls.
Well, let me ask you something that was sort of like, bouncing around my brain, is that, that these monuments, that I think that, the poll says that number, 76% support, but I think a lot of people just are sort of like, well, I don't really care. Why not? Right? And I think that on some level, what they represent and what they say isn't, that important to people. It's just that the monument themselves, the idea of the commandments has almost become a false idol in and of itself.
I think that's right. I think there's also something else that's gone on in recent years. Ten Commandments displays have become embraced by the religious right.
Right.
That isn't an old phenomenon. It's something really in much more recent years. The whole controversy where Roy Moore ended up leaving the chief justiceship of the Alabama Supreme Court over a 5,000-pound, 2.5-ton monument of the Ten Commandments in the courthouse is illustrative of how the religious right has embraced the symbol. But it's precisely because the religious right so much wants that symbol, that message on government property, that it's so important for the Supreme Court to say the government can't endorse religion.
Right, and they also bring up the Pledge of Allegiance under God, and also there's the In God We Trust on the money, which I believe was originally put there as a disclaimer, wasn't it?
Well, there's also a huge difference between a minimal religious reference like In God We Trust or Under God,
sure,
and the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments come directly from the Bible. Those who are believers think that God in his own hand wrote the Ten Commandments on the tablets and gave them to Moses. These are God's commandments for how to behave, both in the religious realm and in daily life. It's very different than the minimal religious content to say, in God we trust.
Yes.
Where do you think the public displays of religion will go if the court upholds them?
Well, I think if the court upholds this, I think you're going to see the religious right try to tremendously increase religious symbols on government property and see how far they can push it. I think that the most important world development in the last couple of decades has been the rise of fundamentalism, whether it's Islamic fundamentalism or Jewish fundamentalism. In this country, it's Christian fundamentalism. And I think that if the Supreme Court rules against my client and upholds these displays, I think we're going to see that really emboldening the religious right to see how far they can go.
Isn't this the seeds of fascism?
Well, I think it is because it's the seeds of intolerance.
Yes.
I mean, what scares me about fundamentalism of every religious stripe is its tremendous intolerance. And that's also the core of fascism.
Thank you so much for joining us, Erwin Chemerinsky. It was great talking to you. We're very excited to see how this turns out. Maybe we'll talk to you again after they rule on this.
I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. 46 past the hour. It's Air America. We'll come back. I want to tell you who else is on that freeze. I want to talk a little bit about what life under fascism looks like and some of those tenets. We're also going to have George Carlin on the Ten Commandments after this, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on the air. Online. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
One past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yeah.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Yes, it is. Oh, there you go. There's the fax machine. That's the liberal agenda coming in from the Streisand compound here. Your marching orders for today. One, support public displays of the Ten Commandments only if they're displayed next to a stone tablet of Ginsburg's howl. Why not? Two, write to HBO. Tell them you'll gladly pay $10 more a month for really dirty shows. Anti-religious, $20. Three, it's Drug and Alcohol Awareness Week. Remember, it's anti-drugs and alcohol. Anti. Four, praise the ACLU for suing Donald Rumsfeld over prison abuse. Then remind them it's okay to win a case once in a while, too. Five, today's phrase, just drop this in the conversation. The bird flu is coming, man, from Vietnam. Agent Orange, My Lai, the Christmas bombing of Cambodia. Connect the dots, sheeple. Welcome to your government-sponsored plague, man. There you go. What is that? So, dude, back into the Ten Commandments. What we were talking about on the break is what Scalia was trying to say is that he wants this to be okay for religion to be infused with government. Like, you know, like a tea infused.
Yeah. I mean, even the Solicitor General of the United States was not prepared to take it that far, was not prepared to say, well, okay, the bottom line here is it is a religious symbol and we're down with that. What Paul Clement tried to say was, well, the commandments have secular importance as a symbol of the law, which I think is a very dangerous thing to say, by the way.
Absolutely, especially given what I was reading yesterday by Davidson Lohr of the Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin, his Living Under Fascism screed in terms of religion and government intertwined as one of the elements of fascistic government. Governments in fascist nations tend to use the most common religion in the nation as a tool to manipulate public opinion. Religious rhetoric and terminology is common from government leaders, even when the major tenets of the religion are diametrically opposed to the government's policies or actions, Scalia acting on behalf of the government here.
Well, yeah, and essentially what they're saying is, well, look, you know, you all shouldn't have any problem with the Ten Commandments. I mean, you know, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal. What's the problem? And see, this is a very, they do this virtually on every front where they're trying to promote these kinds of initiatives. They say, well, you know, what we're talking about is not really what we've been about all our, you know, throughout our existence. It's about these narrow things. If we're going to put up the Ten Commandments, we'll couch it with something else. If we're going to, you know, deal with the abortion debate, we'll kind of, you know, we'll start with partial birth and then we'll work from there. There are all of these little incremental steps that they're taking, but understand that the incremental steps are not the end of the issue. It's not the end of the initiative.
Yeah.
They're going forward.
Right. And they should, you know, it's a matter of really respecting the separation of church and state, really respecting it, having the guts to really respect it as opposed to be nuanced by it. Let's listen to George Carlin from his Complaints and Grievances album of 2001, a CD from 2001 on the Ten Commandments.
About 5,000 years ago, a bunch of religious and political hustlers got together to try to figure out how to control people. They knew people were basically stupid and would believe anything they were told, so they announced that God had given them some commandments. Up on a mountain, when no one was around, God had given them the Ten Commandments. But let me ask you this. When they were sitting around making this shit up, why did they pick 10? Why not 9 or 11? I'll tell you why. Because 10 sounds official. 10 sounds important. They knew if it was 11, people wouldn't take it seriously. Say, what, are you kidding me? The 11 commandments? Get the f*** out of here. But 10. 10 sounds important. The top 10, the 10 most wanted, the 10 best dressed. So having 10 commandments was really a marketing decision. I'm going to show you how you could reduce the number of commandments and come up with a list that's a little more workable and logical. I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not have strange gods before me. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Thou shalt keep holy the Sabbath. Right off the bat, the first three, pure bullshit. Sabbath day, Lord's name, strange gods. Spooky language. Spooky language. Designed to scare and control primitive people. In no way does superstitious nonsense like this apply to the lives of intelligent, civilized humans in the 21st century. You throw out the first three commandments, you're down to 7. Next, honor thy father and mother. Obedience, respect for authority. Just another name for controlling people. The truth is, obedience and respect should not be automatic. They should be earned. Some parents deserve respect. Most of them don't. Period. You're down to 6.
That's the best bit Carlin's done in years. We're going to hear the rest of it over the top of the hour. I also want to share a little bit more about that freeze that is at the back of the Supreme Court that is there, that Christo-fascist honor gates always cite as a reason why religion should be okayed in the government sector. There are many people, many other images and, you know, reliefs on that frieze. I want to talk about that a little bit and hear the rest of that Carlin piece. And he's right about control. These people, they're all about control. It's not about compassion. It's not about anything Christian.
Absolutely.
It's about control.
Well, if we want to talk about some unchristian things, we're also going to talk about bankruptcy and what the Senate is doing to restrict people's ability to declare bankruptcy.
Bad guys.
When we come back here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Did you know that...
It's 6 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition. Geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, smart monkeys of all kinds. That's Mark Riley. I'm Mark Maron.
Yes.
We're in the middle of a conversation about the Ten Commandments. We just got off the phone with Erwin Chemerinsky, who appeared before the U.S. Supreme Court to advocate for the removal of the Ten Commandments yesterday. That was engaging. And we're in the middle of listening to George Carlin's opinions about the Ten Commandments from his album, his CD, Complaints and Grievances, from November 2001. We hear the rest of that, Tim.
Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not bear false witness. Stealing and lying. Well, actually, these two both prohibit the same kind of behavior. Dishonesty, stealing, and lying. So you don't need two of them. Instead, you combine them and you call it thou shalt not be dishonest. And suddenly, you're down to 5. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife. Once again, these two prohibit the same kind of behavior, in this case, marital infidelity. The difference is coveting takes place in the mind, and I don't think you should outlaw fantasizing about someone else's wife. Otherwise, what's a guy going to think about when he's waxing his carrot? But marital fidelity is a good idea, so we're going to keep the idea and call this one, thou shalt not be unfaithful. And suddenly, We're down to four. But when you think about it, honesty and fidelity are really part of the same overall value. So in truth, you could combine the two honesty commandments with the two fidelity commandments and give them simpler language, positive language instead of negative, and call the whole thing, thou shalt always be honest and faithful, and we're down to three. Thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's goods. This one is just plain f***ing stupid. Coveting your neighbor's goods is what keeps the economy going. All right? Your neighbor gets a vibrator that plays "O Come All Ye Faithful." You want to get one too. Coveting creates jobs. Leave it alone. You throw out coveting and you're down to two now. The big honesty and fidelity commandment. And the one we haven't talked about yet. Thou shalt not kill. Murder. The fifth commandment. But when you think about it, religion has never really had a big problem with murder. Not really. More people have been killed in the name of God than for any other reason. All you have to do is look at Northern Ireland, the Middle East, Kashmir, the Inquisition, the Crusades, and the World Trade Center to see how seriously the religious folks take thou shalt not kill. The more devout they are, the more they see murder as being negotiable. It depends on who's doing the killing and who's getting killed. So, with all of this in mind, I leave you with my revised list of the two commandments. Thou shalt always be honest and faithful to the provider of thy nookie. And thou shalt try real hard not to kill anyone. Unless, of course, they pray to a different invisible man from the one you pray to. Two is all you need. Moses could have carried him down the hill in his f***ing pocket. And if they had a list like that, I wouldn't mind those folks in Alabama putting it up on the courthouse wall. As long as they included one additional commandment, thou shalt keep thy religion to thyself.
You see, I don't usually play comedy bits on the show, but, you know, when I was a kid, you know, I was a big Carlin fan when I was a little kid. And, you know, the seven words that you can't say on TV, Class Clown, that album, you know, changed my life. And really, you know, you've been pretty cranky as of late. But that bit really crystallizes as a monumental Carlin bit. I think it's the best bit he's done in 15 years. And the real concern, the thing that's brilliant about Carlin in that bit, and also what we were talking about, is the element of control and the seeds of fascism in this country and the allowance of a deterioration between, you know, the church and state, and what that will mean for the future. You know, we have to really, you know, realize that, Mark, is that there's not a lot of them, but there are seriously ambitious religious fanatics that want to control the government. And as I've been quoting from this thing that I found online, this Davidson Lore, Living Under Fascism, Screed, it's very interesting because it talks about religion and government being intertwined in most fascistic countries. And then also talks about, this is the interesting thing too to me, in relating to the Supreme Court discussion we're having, they always cite that frieze, that statue behind the Supreme Court bench, I think it stands, is Moses. And they say, well, it's in the Supreme Court. But look, there's a lot of people on that frieze, and it's basically a frieze honoring law throughout the entire history of humankind on some level. There are some names here that I can't even pronounce, but I'm going to try because I'm not afraid of being wrong. I'm not afraid of opening my mind a little bit because I'm learning new things here today. And you know what another element of fascism is? Disdain for intellectuals and the arts. Fascist nations tend to promote and tolerate open hostility to higher education and academia. It is not uncommon for professors and other academics to be censored or even arrested. Free expression in the arts is openly attacked, and governments often refuse to fund the arts. Those attacks happen here by condescension, by dismissal, by, what are you, like the Gates are stupid, by just stifling of expression because of belligerence. This stuff happens here. You know, so now I'm going to open my mind a little bit and be a little intellectual just to argue with the idiots that only want to say that Moses is the only one on the wall of the Supreme Court. You have, I believe it's pronounced Menes, M-E-N-E-S. The first figure in the depiction on the south wall, Menes founded Egypt's first dynasty. You have Hammurabi. Hammurabi produced the first surviving set of laws. You have Moses, of course. You have Solomon, regarded as, you know, the great king of Israel, and his name is synonymous with judicial wisdom. You have Lycurgus. You have Solon. I don't know how to pronounce that either, but he's an Athenian whose name survived as a synonym for legislator. He codified the laws of the Greeks and is credited with laying the foundation for the world's first democracy. You have Draco, another prominent legislator of Athens, Confucius, Octavian, you have Justinian, Mohammed, Charlemagne, King John, Mohammed, imagine that, Mohammed on the wall of the American Supreme Court building. Do these people even know that? Louis the Ninth. You have Hugo Grotius, I believe it might be pronounced, a Dutch lawyer who wrote, that's even too complicated for me. He's important, all right? William Blackstone, John Marshall, Napoleon Bonaparte. These are all the other people next to Moses, which renders their stupid argument, even in the symbolic terms, you know, useless, because it doesn't honor the intellectual history, global history of the evolution of law. You know, it's not just about the Ten Commandments, morons. These are people that want to deprive their children of fact-based education by teaching evolution in school. These are people that want to homeschool their kids and diminish their ability to compete in the educational marketplace by having an imagination and ideas of their own. Anyways, enough of my whatever it is I'm doing. But let's talk about what we're going into now, Riley, which is the Republican attack, the Republican, you know, pushing of, you know, revision of bankruptcy laws that are going to hurt a lot of people.
Well, yeah, it's going to hurt an awful lot of people, and they've really kind of given away or bent over for or whatever banks and credit card companies. They are the ones that have been lobbying for a long time to change the bankruptcy law to make it more difficult for individuals, not for corporations, for individuals to declare bankruptcy. And that's what this bill would do. People tried to put amendments to it to try and soften that blow for seniors, for military personnel, for others. Bottom line, the Republicans in the Senate wanted this to go through with no amendments because they wanted to pass in the House that way. And you know, the House has, on many different occasions, for example, the class action lawsuit bill, the House wanted no amendments. That's what the House got. Same thing here. And they defeated Senator Kennedy's amendment. They defeated a number of them. John Corzine from New Jersey put up an amendment. They all got shot down.
This is scary stuff because I'm starting to think that Social Security is a convoluted smokescreen to push through the restricting victims' rights legislation that they want in reaction to tort, and also to push this through, which is also on some level restricting victims' rights. Nobody wants to declare bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is a cush. It's not a, what is it? It's a safety net on some level for people that, you know, lose everything, that need to start over again, that need a little reprieve. It's not taken advantage of. This is a lie. And I'll give you some numbers that prove it's a lie, the way the Republicans are depicting it. When we come back, we're also going to hear a little from Ted Kennedy, all full of the beans instead of full of the juice. I like it when he's on top of things. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition,
the highest rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
Hello. 20 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
The show is Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio. How do you like that? All over the world. Look, you, the last few days we were talking about Frank Luntz. His 14 words never to use from Frank Luntz, a pollster, Republican political consultant, CEO of Luntz Research Companies, had released a 160-page briefing book on how Republicans should be framing the arguments. And these 14 words that you can never say, we've been going through that, and we're going to go through it later in the show. You know, like, never say government, always say Washington. This was originally designed for spouses of Republican politicians, so they were able to lie properly for their husbands and, you know, serve the cause. But obviously it infiltrated my unconscious, Riley, because I go to the therapist today for the first time in 3 weeks, and he's got a head full coming. Here's my dream from last night. I'm a sheep farmer out west, and I'm out on the range with my flock, and it's movie night. Everything's relaxed, and the sheep were psyched about seeing Be Cool. Big Uma Thurman fans of sheep. Anyway, I noticed one of my sheep off by himself having a chat with a coyote, which can never be good. I say, hey, Bob, what the hell are you doing talking to that coyote, man? Get your ass back here. Bob says, sorry, Mark. Actually, he said, sorry, Mark. I chased a coyote who laughed at me as he ran off, the bastard. I turned to Bob and I say, what were you talking about over there anyways? Bob says, personal accounts. I say, personal accounts? You mean privatization? No, Mark, personal accounts. And then all the other sheep say, personal accounts, personal accounts. And I say, wait, what else did you talk about? The estate tax? Bob shakes his head and says, death tax, Mark, death tax. And all the sheep chime in, death tax, death tax. I'm starting to catch on. I say, tax reform. The sheep say, tax simplification. I say, undocumented workers. They say, illegal aliens. Damn, that coyote gave Bob the lunch memo. And he knows how impressionable sheep are. I look around for the coyote, and just over the hill, I spotted him. And Bush and Shaney were dressed like sheep and laughing at us. So I chase them down on my horse. I throw a lasso around all three of them, and then I dangle them over the side of a canyon. Laugh that off, you smelly neocons. I ride back to the sheep, and I say, who wants to go to the movies? And they all say, Uma, Uma. I woke up, and my bed was filled with the smell of leather. How do you like that?
Ooh.
So dig this, man. The Republicans and credit card companies say bankruptcy laws are too lenient, Riley, and allow people to accumulate debts and never pay them off. Now, look, this is interesting because this is the ownership society, right?
Yep.
Isn't that their big word, ownership society? No, this is the debt culture. And nobody does more to encourage and fester debt culture than credit card companies. They get you when you're young. If they could give you a credit card when you were seven, they would. And they probably will.
They can't?
Maybe they can't. I'm just surprised because when I was in college, those guys would come sniffing around, giving people low interest rates, getting college students hooked, already in debt. They love debt. This entire country is in debt, which is a problem. Now, here's the truth that the Republicans won't tell you. 9 out of 10 bankruptcies occur because health costs, loss of employment, or divorce, not irresponsible personal behavior and poor financial planning, as the industry maintains. These guys know they got you, and they're pushing you to bankruptcy. They want you to manage as much debt as possible until you hang yourself with it. Now, the scary thing is, to me, is that let's look at, you know, Howard Dean is taking this tack, too. You know, he's taking the tack that, you know, Republicans, you know, have no right to talk about debt, certainly. They plunged this country into the biggest debt ever, and they are fiscally irresponsible people, especially the administration that we have now. Now, this bill that they're trying to push through, Riley, okay, they stopped some Democratic amendments. They're all Democratic amendments, aren't they?
Yeah. There were actually 6 in all, except for one. There was one that was accepted. It was one that was by Sessions, Republican from Alabama.
Well, let's talk about the good thing later. Let's talk about the bad things.
Well, even his amendment wasn't that great a thing.
And it was a concession to the other amendment dealing with the military.
Exactly.
To give a break to active duty military personnel and some veterans who filed for bankruptcy. All right? They said no. Republicans said no to people who are over there fighting in Iraq. God knows, you know, what are they making a living off of soldiers' pay? You know, their wives are strapped, one kid, two kid on the way. Who the hell knows? But no, can't give those guys a concession on the bankruptcy thing. Can't give them a break.
You know, it's amazing when you start looking at these votes, because and it's not like they were really asking for all that much, Mark. These
That's
amendments.
Right.
Senator Ted Kennedy actually put up 2, both of which were rejected.
What were they about?
Well, Kennedy's amendments, let's see, one was to provide protection for medical debt owners. I'm sorry, medical debt homeowners. That's the wrong thing. And there was also one that was rejected. Exempt debtors whose financial problems were caused by serious medical problems, and this was to exempt them from means testing, because that's what this bill would do. They would say if you make over a certain amount of money, you would not be able to discharge your debts through bankruptcy.
So you're saying they're trying to push people who are filing for personal bankruptcy, Chapter 7, into a Chapter 13 situation.
Exactly.
If you file Chapter 7, you're off the hook on some level, except for the shame and the guilt and the bad credit and having to rebuild your entire life from square one, all right, and push you into a Chapter 13 situation, which means you got to pay us back.
And you know what's the amazing thing now? Remember that there's a third bankruptcy protection. That's Chapter 11.
Of course, I remember that.
Okay, now that will allow corporations to continue functioning while they're broke,
yeah,
while they declare their bankruptcy. Many, many different companies, many pillars of corporate America.
Well,
have been able to declare bankruptcy, get their finances in order. I have to pay everything back. You think they pay everything back? Of course not.
No, because there's a loophole for the wealthy. Legal specialists say that the proposed law leaves open an increasingly popular loophole that lets wealthy people protect substantial assets from creditors even after filing for bankruptcy. This is not even a business. By setting up offshore accounts through banks in one of five states, even if they don't live in any of the five states. See, that's just for the wealthy people, not just the Chapter 11 on a corporate level, which is what crumbled this country, for God's sakes. The economy's in a disaster because it lets those guys off the hook. Am I right?
This is the result, Mark, of literally millions upon millions of dollars being spent on lobbying on the part of banks and credit card companies.
But if they get this through, if they get these restricting victims' rights legislation through and this bankruptcy thing through, they've really done a tremendous disservice to human beings in America.
The bankruptcy bill is going to pass, unfortunately. It's going to pass the Senate. It's going to go to the House. It will probably sail through the House.
We'll hear from Ted Kennedy after this break.
Air America Radio.
Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Reilly on Air America Radio.
And now, the Morning Sedition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of The Shadow Government.
When last we left Mark, he had discovered that Crawford Ranch was nothing but Hollywood film scenery. So he headed for Los Angeles to find the film company, the mysterious Inauguration Studios.
People wonder why they call it the City of Angels. Maybe it's because it's full of so many lost souls. I staked out Inauguration Studios and watched them all come and go. All those wannabes with crazier dreams of success and Paul Wolfowitz staring at a brand new Atlas. That's when I saw him. Oh my God. He walked right out of the studio. The robe. The beard. Was I the only one who saw this? It was Osama bin Laden.
Well, okay. If the executives reconsider, let me know.
Hold it right there, enemy of America.
This again. On top of everything else. Look, whoever you are, I'm not Osama bin Laden. You're only the 100th guy who's asked, okay?
Yeah, sure. That's what they all say. All those bin Ladens.
Look, I'm going to reach slowly into my pocket now and show you my studio ID. I'm an actor, okay?
It says your name is Tommy Friendly.
My real name is Rajay Srinivasan from India. I just play Osama bin Laden for Inauguration Studios. Well, I used to.
What are you talking about? I haven't seen you.
Well, certainly you have. Video clips, photographs, any time you see a villain for a movie or a documentary or a news program. 3 years ago, I was the hottest actor in Hollywood. Now I can't get arrested in this town.
You mean they're making propaganda
in
that...
Well, of course I can get arrested in this town, God knows. Try mailing a package when you're dressed like this.
You mean they're making propaganda in that studio?
Well, the client prefers to call it news.
So why aren't you working anymore?
Who knows? It's Hollywood. I once got fired from a commercial because I didn't look enough like a fruit roll-up.
I've got to hear what's going on. Can you get me in there?
And I lost 30 pounds for that part. I'll get you in. Oh, yes, sure. Just go down into this drain here. Follow this river of sewage, and when you come up, you're in the programming department.
Okay, thanks. Boy, all these actors trying to break into a studio, and it turns out you just have to swim through a mile of slime. I found myself in an air duct, looking through a vent at a meeting of executives. All of a sudden, into the meeting walks Michael Powell. Maybe he'd lead me to his dad.
Gentlemen, I call the corporate media conspiracy to order. Now, gentlemen, as you know, my employer wishes to have a new villain to overshadow Osama bin Laden, someone the public can really despise, so let's hear your pitches.
How about the King of Saudi Arabia? They've got a pretty awful record of human rights abuses.
For reasons I am not at liberty to disclose, my employer does not wish to trouble the Saudi ruling family. Other ideas?
King Matswani III of Swaziland? He shops for $50 million jets while his people live in huts.
Is Swaziland any kind of threat to us?
Well, we could say they're building a really dangerous spear.
That's pathetic, Larry. Oh, we need another Saddam Hussein. We got to attack him when he hadn't even done anything to us. Remember when he had all those British hostages during the first Gulf War? He tried to be charming with this one kid on camera, and the boy just twitched like a paralyzed rabbit. God, he was a good villain.
Mr. Powell, something doesn't smell right.
Well, of course not. We're writing propaganda.
No, I mean something in the room.
Yeah, it's like sewage. I think it's coming from that vent.
Uh-oh.
I'll call the janitor later.
That was close. Just gotta hold still and not give myself away. Is that a cell phone? Damn it.
Hey, Mark, this is Blanche. Your assistant slash dog walker slash Clay.
Blanche, why do you have to call now?
Hey, there's somebody in there.
I got nowhere to go. Gotta kick out the vent and take this thing head on.
All right, you guys. This is a 44 Magnum, so nobody move. Powell, you and I are clearing out of here together.
Well, I wouldn't do that if I were you, Marin.
Why not? What could you do to me?
Well, I am in charge of the FCC. I could order your producer to end this episode right now.
Oh, yeah, sure, right. I'd like to see...
Why does the government want to make everyone forget about Bin Laden? Why hasn't Mark changed the ringtone on his cell phone? And why would a sewer connect to an air vent? Isn't that just bad architecture? Find out next time when we hear Mark say...
Blanche! They're coming for me!
I don't want to talk about our relationship!
That's next time on The Shadow Government. And stay tuned later for Morning's Edition Radio Theater's production of The World Yet to Come. Travel with us to the far, far future, all the way to the year 1997. Men fly about in jetpacks. Diseases have all been cured. Mutant androids have seized Brazil. And a woman named Ellen DeGeneres becomes the first openly gay woman to have her own sitcom. Let's see what Mark Riley and Mark Maron are talking about in this strange and distant world.
So, you want to catch a movie or something?
Nah, I don't think that's a good idea.
Why not?
Because we're not even going to meet each other for another 7 years.
Oh, yeah. Then what are you doing in my house?
Hey, that's my stereo!
That's coming up later on Morning's Edition Radio Theater.
That's it.
Come back here, slacker!
40 past the hour. It's Morning's Edition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
We're in the middle of a discussion about bankruptcy legislation. I do want to say that tonight I am going to be on the Ostroy Dean Report, where Democrats play rough. It's a political call-in show, a weekly show. It's at 6:30 tonight. It's every Thursday. It's on here in New York City on Time Warner Channel 57, and it's on RCN Channel 109. And if you're out of town, you can go to the internet to MNN.org and just follow the steps to watch MNN. It's also available on ham radio, apparently.
Okay. MNN, that's Manhattan Neighborhood Network.
Yes. It's Nathan Dean and Andy Ostroy. That'll be tonight. I'm curious about a call-in television show, Riley. You know, I said, can I come down to studio, fellas? They're like, well, there's really no room with the two of us in there. I'm like, what are you broadcasting from a closet? But nonetheless, I will be on there looking forward to it. Now, let's get back into these amendments that were shut down by the Republicans. First, the one we talked about before the break. And by the way, I want to solicit some calls for after the next break about bankruptcy, because it's a myth that bankruptcy is about fiscal irresponsibility on individuals' behalf. I mean, 9 out of 10 bankruptcies occur because health costs, loss of employment, or divorce, not irresponsible personal behavior or poor financial planning, as the industry and the Republicans maintain. So if you've had an experience with personal bankruptcy and how it helped you out, we've gotten many emails about this because many people feel this is an important bit of legislation to fight. Call us at 866-303-2270. And let's talk about these Democrats that didn't fight. Why, Riley?
Well, Joe Biden from Delaware was not present for the voting on any of the amendments that were rejected. Now, you could say it was a lopsided vote, so maybe his vote wouldn't have mattered, but you have to keep in mind that Delaware is considered, along with New York, to be the capital of the credit card industry, the capital of places where businesses incorporate. It's a business-friendly state. His colleague, Tom Carper, also from Delaware, voted with the majority, with the Republicans on this, even though he's a Democrat.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you also have Nelson and Johnson from Nebraska and South Dakota, respectively. Also places where you have large numbers of credit card companies.
So they're on the tip of the credit card companies, these cats, these Democrats. So, you know, what about these amendments, the amendment that would have allowed older people to get homestead exemptions to keep their homes when they file for bankruptcy? That was shut down by the Republicans. Anti-old people,
yes.
Right? Two proposals focused on helping people whose significant medical expenses for illness forced them to file bankruptcy. Shut down by the Republicans. An amendment to give a break to active duty military personnel and some veterans who filed for bankruptcy. Now, being in the military, not a lucrative profession. Also, the strains of being in the military, being stationed overseas, strains the relationship, strains your financial disposition, sets a scene where bankruptcy can happen. Do the Republicans care? Apparently not. Shut it down.
Well, you know, they are not even prepared to allow or to force the credit card companies to tell people exactly how long it's going to take to pay off their debt. That was one amendment that was rejected. And again, rejected by a 59-40 vote in the Senate.
All right, let's hear that. Let's hear a little Ted Kennedy. Can we hear a little Ted Kennedy, Tim, who's sitting in for Chris, the Costco ho?
In the past 8 years, the profits of credit card companies have more than doubled to $30 billion, and still they want more. And they're asking Congress to give them special privileges that will give them even more profits, all on the backs of hardworking middle-class families.
All right, we're going to hear some more from Ted after the break. We're going to hear more. We're going to hear from you guys about bankruptcy and about this restriction of your rights to. Just people don't realize that there's no one wants to file for bankruptcy. It's not like people are saying, "Man, well, I could just file for bankruptcy." Maybe a few do, but there's a few bad apples, a few devious, sort of selfish types, and in every batch. You know, most of them are Republican. All right, so 866-303-2270 is the number. I want you, Riley, to educate me on means tests as well. When we come back, it's Air America Radio.
Join the morning sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
The hour taking calls about your experience with personal bankruptcy and how it saved your life, helped you out. 866-303-2270 is the number, because the Republicans want people to believe, and the credit card companies obviously, that the reason bankruptcies occur is because you're just irresponsible. And the truth of the matter is 9 out of 10 bankruptcies occur because of health costs, loss of employment, or divorce. Not irresponsible personal behavior. We've got a little more Ted Kennedy to lay down here in relation to this bill being pushed through. And, Riley, you tell me it's going to pass, which scares me.
8 million of our fellow citizens unemployed. School tuition's going up through the roof. And we're talking about additional $5 billion for the most profitable industry in America.
That's an angry Kennedy.
Yeah, he's angry, and I think rightly so. In the last election cycle, the credit card and banking industries contributed something on the order of $7.4 million to various and sundry candidates. 63% of that money went to Republicans. And you see that in shooting down these amendments that they were trying to tack onto this bankruptcy bill, the Republicans maintained an extraordinary discipline. Not a single one of them crossed party lines on any of these amendments.
Living under fascism, Davidson Lohr, the Unitarian Universalist Church in Austin. Living under fascism, number 13, rampant cronyism and corruption. Fascist regimes almost always are governed by groups of friends and associates who appoint each other to government positions and use government power and authority to protect their friends from accountability. It is not uncommon in fascist regimes for national resources and even treasures to be appropriated or even outright stolen by government leaders. They're talking about your house. Phil, in Florida, how are you?
Hey, Phil.
Oh, I'm here.
Hey, how good, man? Well, that's good. What happened?
Well, one day I went to the doctor and said I didn't feel well, and 4 days later they're cracking my chest open.
Wow.
And I'm, you know, I've been paying for my health insurance all along.
Yep.
And the health insurance company authorized all the procedures and everything. And 5 months after the surgery, and I've already lost a whole lot because I was out of work and didn't have that kind of money.
Sure.
The insurance company is saying, we're not going to pay this because it's a previous condition.
After all was said and done, they paid for the surgery, then they cut you loose?
Well, yeah, but they didn't know. They didn't pay for the surgery.
Oh, my God.
So
they didn't?
Now the doctors and the hospitals and the anesthesiologists and all of this are suing me for $280,000.
Oh, my God.
Whoa.
And the only way I had to protect myself was to claim bankruptcy. I'm just a truck driver. I don't make that kind of money.
That's ridiculous. You're the victim of two Republican policies. You're a victim of the insurance industry that has no that they don't care about people. And now, you know, well, thank God you were able to do it. Did it help you out?
Oh, well, yeah. You know, let me at least get back on my feet.
Well, yeah. You know what? If you, under this bill, if you make over a certain amount of money, you would not be able to discharge your debts under bankruptcy anymore. You would
Absolutely.
Have to then schedule a repayment plan of that $280,000 or at least a portion of it.
That's right.
Well, the truth of the matter is your insurance, you know, should have covered it. That's a ridiculous
loophole. That is ridiculous.
Loophole. And
well,
I'm glad.
What happened was the day that my bankruptcy was final and my debts were discharged, the insurance company settled with the doctors in the hospital for much less money than what was originally billed.
God, it sounds like a racket.
So they made out like a bandit.
Absolutely.
Wow, incredible. Phil, thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot, Phil. I'm glad you're doing all right.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, let's talk to Mike in Brooklyn. How are you, Mike?
What's up, Mike?
Good morning.
Hey.
Hi.
What's up?
I just spoke with your swing caller. I just feel with as far as with bankruptcy, everything is when you file for bankruptcy and when you're extending credit from a credit card company, they do a background check on you, and they offer you a certain amount of limit which they feel that you can handle. Now, as far as with the bankruptcies and what's going on, you know, if you as a person with personal responsibility, if you accept that responsibility of saying, okay, a credit card gave me 10% APR, $1,000 credit limit, and now if you over-exceed that, if you run out and start spending crazy and you find that you went over on your late fees and you're over the credit limit, APR goes up higher, which is in contract with everything's explained to you.
Right.
If you put yourself in a situation where you can't handle it no more, you know, when you go for bankruptcy, you own things. If you have personal assets, you can't just run and go bankruptcy and keep everything that you own because everything will be liquefied and given to the creditors.
Okay,
What chapter bankruptcy are we talking about here, Mike?
I believe that you're talking about Chapter 7?
Yeah. Chapter 7 does allow you to discharge your debts under certain circumstances. It does, in fact, allow you to insulate yourself from your creditors. But, Mike, the problem with your argument is that 9 out of 10 bankruptcies don't occur because people overextend credit cards on that level. They occur because of health care costs, because people lose their jobs, or in the case of many, many women, it's divorce.
Okay, well, if women get divorced, they have to go through a divorce court. I mean, what? So a married couple's married for 20 years, and a man divorces the woman, and what you're saying is the woman is left with all the debt, and the man keeps all the money, and he goes and lives happily ever after?
No, the women, in many instances, are saddled with expenses that their husbands may have run up that they cannot pay for.
And that's a contract between a married couple, and when they end that contract, they have to divide that equally, that they have accumulated together.
Oh, they do?
If they married this man, you know, if they married for 10 years and the man ran up all the bad credit, well, the woman should have seen this 10 years ago.
10 years ago?
10 years ago?
The truth of the matter is, you know, God willing, you don't get into some sort of trouble like the guy who we talked to last time who
right.
got screwed
I mean,
by his insurance company.
Bankruptcy is just a personal accountability. There are situations where a person might get sick.
But that's not true. The evidence doesn't show that. It's not just a personal accountability. There are things that happen in people's lives that are completely out of the control that force them into economic predicaments that they could not have foresaw, that they could not have taken responsibility for. And bankruptcy is not something that people take lightly. It's a way that they can start their lives again.
But on the percentages
are wrong. The percentages are wrong. No, it isn't. These are numbers that we have. One out of ten accommodate your point of view. 9 out of 10 say that you're wrong.
All right.
Thanks.
And remember this, too, Mike. When it comes to wealthy people, they can still create offshore accounts that allow them, even under this revised bankruptcy bill, avoid having to pay.
But his logic, it's flawed, and his belligerence is understandable if somebody who's not had to deal with this. The truth of the matter is that these aren't people looking, you know, people aren't looking to go bankrupt. And, you know, it's not that people are sitting there saying, I can always go bankrupt. We just took a call from a guy who had to have heart surgery because his insurance company pulled out on him. Like, you know, the guy is wrong.
Well, yeah, and the thing is, corporations take advantage of bankruptcy laws all the time. They take advantage of the law so that they can keep functioning. And you'll notice that this bankruptcy bill does nothing to change Chapter 11 bankruptcy.
9 out of 10 bankruptcies occur because of health costs, loss of employment, or divorce. Not because someone said, no, what the hell, I'm just going to spend some more, they let me. And don't underestimate the power of credit card companies to pull people into their scam. They keep up in your credit. You know, just because they give you a certain amount of credit when you start doesn't mean that they love it when you get into debt. And that may be a responsibility, but it also may be, I need the money now because I'm hurting and I got to get myself into debt to take the risk to get out.
Mm, absolutely.
All right, we got to go. We're going to come back. We're going to do more calls. We're going to talk about Tom DeLay. We'll take a couple more calls. We're going to talk about Tom DeLay. And we're going to have a poll that shows that Bush isn't doing so good, which always makes us happy.
Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
This is Jeff.
Six past the hour of the show is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, smart monkeys of all kinds. Of course, working class heroes. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning, Tim the librarian in for Kayla the Costco ho. Good morning, Clutch Larson, P.W. McDonald on the phones. Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, New Jersey, out in the night finding articles for you. He has put a link up to the thing I've been quoting for the last 2 days, the Davidson Lohr piece from the Unitarian Universalist Church of Austin, the Living Under Fascism screed that I find to be very inspiring and informative. We're talking about bankruptcy. We have been talking about bankruptcy. Later in this hour, you should really hang out. We've got Azudeh Moaveni. She is an author. Her book is Lipstick Jihad, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America and American in Iran. She's worked throughout the Middle East as a reporter. She's covered the war for the Los Angeles Times. I'm very excited to meet her. It's going to be a very engaging conversation. That's later in the hour. Right now we're discussing bankruptcy and how this why bankruptcy can help people, and that the characterization that people who file for bankruptcy are irresponsible when 9 out of 10 bankruptcies occur because of health costs, loss of employment, or divorce, all right, not personal behavior or poor financial planning, as the Republicans and the credit cards would have you believe, credit card companies. We're talking to people. On the phone, we have Anna in Boston. Anna, what's on your mind?
Hi, Anna.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
This show's great. I love it.
Thank you.
I had to file bankruptcy in 1988. My husband, I threw him out because he was beating my children.
Oh, my God.
And I was stuck with one paycheck instead of two. I owned a home with my mother and stepfather.
Mm-hmm.
My mother passed away 2 months later.
Mm.
We lost her Social Security check. My stepfather passed away a year and a half later. And then I lost my job.
Wow.
Wow. I had no income. I didn't even have the first check of unemployment, which was only half of what I made. I was trying to live on $150 a week. I lost my home.
Oh, my God.
I lost everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I was totally defeated. And it saved my life.
And how are you doing now, okay?
Oh, I'm doing well. I'm 67 years old and still working.
All right. Well, I'm glad it helped you out. I mean, that's a pretty tough story. And some of these Republicans would accuse you of being irresponsible. How
absolutely
dare they?
Absolutely not.
That's
absolutely
right.
Not.
Thank you, Anna, for your call.
Thank you. You know, she makes a very, very cogent point about who it is that's the client. This is a 67-year-old woman who is still working. She's managed to survive bankruptcy. She managed to survive the loss of family, loss of income, the whole nine yards, loss of job.
But she thanks God every day that her Social Security money's protected.
Yeah, now what
and not being gambled away.
What would have happened had she been means tested and been forced to pay off whatever the bankruptcy debt was?
Mm-hmm.
Would she be where she is today? The answer is probably no.
Well, she still lost her house, but you know what? I mean, sometimes
she's still with us.
That's right, and you know, and that reprieve, that buys you a little time. I mean, I came close to having to file bankruptcy, but I didn't. I decided to get further in debt and gamble. You know, but that's what you're doing. That's not irresponsible. You've only got a couple of choices. You say, you know, I got this line of credit. All right, so if I think I can get back on my feet, you know, I'm going to go ahead and use this line of credit. That's why I got it. I mean, I don't carry any debt. I don't like to. It gives me the creeps.
Well, you know, what's strange about this is people will talk and couch, even one of the callers, couch in the terms of personal responsibility. But the fact of the matter is, when you start looking at corporate bankruptcy, the rules of responsibility for individuals don't seem to apply. Corporations can, you know, slide in and out of bankruptcy virtually at will.
Right. And that's the thing. It's like I don't carry debt because I go, you know, it scared me just to have to do that. But this entire culture is about debt. Bush says it's about ownership, but that's really debt. I never bought a house before. Buying a house means, all right, now you are owned by the bank. You and the bank own the house.
Yeah.
You and your credit card companies own that, you know, stereo or whatever. But the real thing about credit is that if you take a chance and you use it, you know, when you have to, you know, you might risk, you know, going bankrupt. You know, you might risk it, but, you know, you got to do what you have to do before you go bankrupt and try to save your ass any way you can. But that's not personal irresponsibility. Sometimes when I got divorced, when my life fell apart, you know, you got to take the credit. You got to try and make your life better. And if it doesn't happen that way, what are you going to do?
You know, it's amazing that people try and couch this in the whole notion that, well, you know, they're just out here with credit cards, spending up this, buying this, getting bling bling the whole nine yards. And the fact of the matter is, as you pointed out at the very beginning of this discussion, Mark, that, you know, the credit card companies at one point were, there were a couple of very well publicized stories where credit card companies were sending out, credit cards to people's pets, to people's small children. I mean, they were, you know, and not just, you know, a solicitation for credit. They were sending the actual plastic to people. One person, I think, it was their dog that actually got a credit card in the mail.
And come on.
I swear to God. They made out a credit card. To, it was, you know, like Fido Smith or something.
You got that poll about Bush?
Oh, yeah, I do.
You know, we've been talking about Frank Luntz's 14 Words Never to Use, a reframing article, and we haven't gotten to a lot of it, and we still got about five more to go, but I wanted to get this in, and I also want to get Tom DeLay, the bug-killing dwarf king of the neocon death cult's legislative pig pack, as he had slandered some seniors, slandered the AARP. I want to talk about that when we come back, and
yeah.
Also we got a copy of an ad that was put together by the same people who put together the Swift Boat ad, you know, with the USA Next. That's the front group of the Republican retired, the pseudo-retired group.
Yeah.
Retired
conservatives.
Yeah, it's a lie. It's a front group. They hired the same people that did the Swift Boats ad to do these, AARP, anti-AARP ads. We got one when we come back, but I want to talk. What's this poll say, Riley?
Well, what the poll essentially says, and this is a CBS News, New York Times poll, that Bush does not share the priorities of most Americans, particularly on the issue of Social Security. 51% said permitting individuals to invest part of their Social Security taxes in private accounts was a bad idea. That is a statistical majority of the people who were polled. That number jumped to 69% if respondents were told that the accounts would result in a reduction of guaranteed benefits. You're seeing the White House, by the way, starting to adjust their strategy on Social Security ever so slightly to reflect this. And what it means is that 18% more people believe that if the benefits are going to get cut, and that is an inevitability under Bush's existing plan, that if they cut the benefits, this is a bad idea.
They don't want nothing to do with it.
Absolutely
not.
It's
practical. Do you know, you want to have your money protected and keep the money there, or do you want to take a chance on the wheel? We'll be back with what Tom DeLay said about the AARP and the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth people have made an ad that we think you ought to hear. It's 14 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Tradition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
We're back. It's 18 past the hour. Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hi.
The show is Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. In a little while, we're going to be talking to Azude Moaveni, who is the author of, you know, pronounce it like that. I was pronouncing it like that because I was trying to pronounce it correctly. I don't want to offend her. Lipstick Jihad, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America and America in Iran. You know what? I keep getting that thing, that commercial for CNN in my head. But that's like, it's not Iran. It's not Iraq. There is no I. What's her name? The reporter?
Christiane Amanpour.
Yeah. Anyways, here, I got the iNews 5000 thing right here, you know, the machine that I got so to translate the headlines.
Yeah.
You know, I bought it a couple of weeks ago with the brand new iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. And we usually have music for this, but I like Brendan doing the music better than I like the music. So, all right, here's the headline for the New York Times. High Court debates commandments displays. Let's put that into the machine. Translation, court ponders lawn statuary, ceramic deer, jockeys next. From the London Guardian about Microsoft's Bill Gates. Philanthropic Gates made honorary knight. Philanthropic Gates made honorary knight. Translation, newly knighted Gates vows to defend empire against pop-up ads. Yes, thank God. From MSNBC, stripper selling infamous breast implant on eBay. Stripper selling infamous breast implant on eBay. Translation, analysts applaud eBay's new direction as bold, firm, perky. How do you like that? Let's do the outro now. Right, let's get back into this now. You know, Tom DeLay, the bug-killing dwarf king of the neocon death cult legislating pig pack, said that the AARP are basically, he said, incredibly irresponsible to be against a solution that hasn't been written yet. Really, really, it's incredibly irresponsible for a bunch of retired people to see what they've experienced in life, to determine what they believe to be right on the basis of their Social Security plan, and then to try to dictate what will be good for people in the future. Really, that's so irresponsible, isn't it, Mark?
Well, I mean, is it the AARP's fault that this hasn't been written yet? I thought Bush was supposed to be writing it. Bush has been keeping the details of this plan deliberately vague. He's given himself an exit strategy with Social Security in saying, well, we're welcoming all kinds of ideas about how to reform the system. We're starting to see some new ideas creep in, but that's the reason why this isn't written. It has nothing to do with the AARP. DeLay is just taking a political shot across the bow of this organization, and guess who he may be doing it in service of?
Who's that?
Those same USA Next people that are setting themselves up as the conservative version of the AARP.
Just another one of the neocon death cults, you know, front organizations who have contracted the same guys who did the Swift Boat ads to take on the AARP. They did a print ad, what was that, a couple of weeks ago, connecting or trying to connect, assuming, or what's the word I'm looking for, suggesting that the AARP was pro-gay marriage.
And
which
anti-social.
An anti-soldier, that's the problem. And they put it up on a website, you know, at the, was it American Spectator? Was that what it was?
Yeah.
Where they had, you know, no little X across the soldier and a little check with the two men kissing. And it was just, it was a slanderous propaganda campaign.
It was a provocation. It was Charlie Jarvis and the USA Next people putting that up there to see how people would react to it.
Well, you want to hear provocation. I mean, we just got a copy the radio ad, the radio campaign that they're starting. These are the Swift Boat people, the Charlie Jarvis people, are now trying to provoke and clearly, you know, completely slander the AARP. Can we hear that ad, Tim? It's sad.
The American Association of Retired Persons is opposing President Bush's plans for Social Security. Why would they do that? If you want to know the truth about old people, talk to the people who know them.
Old people are needy. I need a ride. I need a walker. I need something to eat. Could somebody please help me? I'm in the toilet. I can't get out. It's horrendous.
I have to spend 15 minutes helping my mother find her glasses because she forgot where she put them. Just forgot.
Dude, they crap in their pants.
Enough about World War II. I get it. You were there.
I'm sorry, but if you're going to dinner at 4 o'clock, you really don't need more money.
You liberated Auschwitz. You were there. I understand. Can we watch The Apprentice now?
And when they wear those diapers, they can pee right on themselves, too. Just pee.
Brian! Name is Brian! God!
I remember this one time, my uncle, he was on the floor. I thought he was having a heart attack or he was dead or something. Turns out he wasn't. Just on the floor.
Who the hell is Bobby? Nobody knows Bobby!
Dude, they crap their pants.
Old people. They oppose President Bush's plans for Social Security. Isn't it time they died already?
Paid for by Swift Boat Veterans for whatever cause is being funded by the right-wing millionaires at the moment.
Wow. That's,
you've done it now.
That's powerful stuff. I mean, it's awful what those people do. Look, you know, we got the Frank Luntz, 14 words never to use. This is a reframing for Republicans. It was part of a 160-page briefing book given to Republican spouses to help them lie for their husbands. We've gone through a lot of them. There's a few that we haven't gone through yet. Like it says here, here's one. Never say undocumented workers. Always say illegal aliens.
Yep.
Right, you know that one.
Oh, yeah. And they've been using, they've been running that for a touchdown for years.
I think Lou Dobbs uses that one. Everybody, a lot of people use that one on TV. Never say foreign trade. Always say international trade.
Yeah, because foreign has a distasteful inference in the minds of the focus group people that Frank Luntz uses to determine these things.
Devious. Never say drilling for oil. Always say exploring for energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got a few frames of our own, you know. You know what I mean? We've got our frame for, you know, the opposing the sort of evolution, the intelligent design, teaching intelligent design. We
yeah.
believe that kids deserve a fact-based education. They talk about tort reform, or as they, here's a couple frames here. Never say trial lawyer. Always say personal injury lawyer, which is a lie, and it doesn't represent the truth. And then never say tort reform. Always say lawsuit abuse reform. What we like to say is, restricting victims' rights.
Right. Yeah.
What we like to say is, it's not about moral values, it's about human rights. What we like to say is, you know, when we talk about people like Dobson, people about who are against these moral issues, we say that that's the war on tolerance.
Yeah, and you know, this is seeped all throughout the public discussion and certainly even seeped into the White House. I mean, remember that the whole issue of personal injury, remember that George W. Bush, when he went on the attack against John Edwards, what did he call him? A personal injury lawyer.
Yeah, because that trivializes it and makes it seem like those guys you see advertising on TV.
It makes it sound like they're ambulance chasers. That's
right.
What it makes them sound like.
In this briefing, they've even co-opted the choice.
Yeah.
The choice idea from the left, and they say, and never say health care choice, instead say the right to choose. So they've actually stolen a frame that we have, which is, I like the reproductive freedom frame better. I think that's, you know, what needs to be said, reproductive freedom, okay?
Yeah.
And then also, here we have the ownership society. I prefer culture of debt.
You know, one of the things that they do with this is to attempt to make people feel good about supporting these kinds of issues, whether it's, you know, drilling for oil, whether it's tort reform, whatever, trial lawyer, all these different things. The reframing tends to make supporters feel good about backing these
people. That's right, because they're like, I can say, let me say it. It's not, if they're what is it? They're a trial lawyer, ambulance chasers. Oh, I think I got it wrong. I can feel smart. Let me have the paper again. We'll be back. We're going to talk to Azude Moaveni after this. It's 27 past the hour.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Hey, it's 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley there.
Yo.
The show is Morning Sedition. The network is Air America Radio. We'll be talking to Alzudeh Moavani momentarily about her book, Lipstick Jihad, and a lot of other things, the Middle East in general. But right now, since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now on the phone, once again, is Planet Push correspondent Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Good morning, Mark. God's got an hourglass, but he's running out of sand.
Okay, very nice. The metaphor is always nice, Lawton. Now let's talk some more about Social Security. Bush's plan will be a disaster for the elderly, my friend. So help me understand something. What is the first Bush administration, what is the Bush administration policy, this Bush administration, towards old people, Lawton? Could you help me out with that?
Yeah, I like it when you ask questions, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Your curiosity is very gentlemanly.
Oh, man.
Okay, here's how it goes.
Yeah.
President George W. two-terms mandate Bush is pro-elderly but anti-old.
you lost me, Lawton. Can you help me out?
Okay, now the elderly are your cute senior folks who vote Republican and wear red Sansa belt slacks and have huevos rancheros at the country club. Distinguished, silver-haired, collect humbles. Drive white Cadillacs.
Okay.
Like to put fruit in jars.
Okay.
I'm picturing Barbara Bush right now. They smell like vanilla.
Okay, Lawton. So now, who are old people then?
Everyone opposing the president's Social Security plan. Even if you're 14, if you're against it, you're old.
Okay.
Deal
with it.
All Welcome to Geezerville, Mark. Man. I'm looking at you, okay? Here's your diaper.
Wait, whoa. So I guess the AARP.
All right.
So I guess the AARP would qualify as a bunch of old people.
Yes, indeed. Cut them open and count the rings, Mark.
Oh,
those whiny old AARP hippies were too busy blowing reefer during the 60s to make enough money to live on. So now they have to suck our teeth dry with their Social Security. Tom DeLay told me how to spot them. You know, as they get older, they actually get lines on their faces. It's repulsive.
Now, you know what? All right, now, wait a minute. They worked hard. They earned it. Don't those people have the right to sue to a secure retirement as anyone else? Why should we gamble with their future, Lawton? Why?
Okay, you don't pay to fix up an old car.
Uh-huh.
Why should we pay to keep these obsolete clunkers on our highway?
Well,
that's like still playing Pong on a Commodore 64. That's like watching Logan's Run on Betamax or driving a Subaru Brat. Come on, Mark.
Okay, wait. So
more progress, my friend.
So if we just throw old people away, then we won't have to deal with them. Is that the crux of your argument here?
Oh, your bluntness is hurtful, Mark.
What?
All right, imagine this, though. If old people keep getting these handouts every month, they could live forever.
Well, you know, Lawton, if they're healthy and active in the 80s or 90s, you know, they could live that long, 80s or 90s. Why not?
Well, if that's the case, put them to work. Come on. Well, then, all that Social Security money the Wall Street fellas will be making for them, it'll trickle right down to them. Brokers tip waiters real well, and then the waiters will kick some back to the dishwashers.
No.
It's a real sweet deal.
I can't. You know what?
I
don't know. Yeah, Lawton, I can't believe you think so little of senior citizens. Come on, buddy. What happened? Did someone you love get old and die? What happened? Did somebody die, Lawton?
No.
No, come on. Be honest with me.
No.
Please.
No.
There you go. Let it out, buddy.
No.
Let it out. Come on.
I can't believe you brought up Ronald Reagan. I thought we were friends. After Roddy passed, I made a vow I would never love anything old ever again.
Uh-huh.
Not Old Navy, Old Spice, Old Milwaukee. Nothing old.
Oh, boy.
Does anybody here see my old friend Roddy? Can you tell me where he's gone?
Lawton, you got to stop. You got to stop. I didn't mean to upset you, buddy. You got to stop singing. You got to stop singing. All right? Just take it easy. Pull it together. I'm glad I see you. Yeah. You all right? Okay. Are you okay?
Old people get discounts for everything.
No.
They should get charged more, don't you think?
They sit
in there and rattle their bags.
Come on.
Make noise and eat penny candy and talk through the movie.
All right.
They should get charged more.
No.
God loves you.
All right, you take care, Lawton. You take care.
Deal with it.
All right. All right, you got me. Wow. That was, you know, that was, he was full of the beans today. Right now, okay, we are pleased to have in our studio today the author of Lipstick Jihad, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America and American in Iran. She worked throughout the Middle East as a reporter for Time Magazine. She covered the war in Iraq for the Los Angeles Times. As a journalist, she interviewed a lot of people we talk about here on this show, and hopefully we'll talk to her about some of those. Please welcome Azadeh Moaveni. Good morning.
Good morning.
Did I pronounce it right?
You did.
I've been practicing all day.
Perfect.
All day. It's unbelievable.
He came in the office practicing.
Now, tell, you know, you have a very interesting background because you live in Beirut. You're Iranian, okay, and you went to school at the University of Santa Cruz.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a hippie school. What's the process that got you to Beirut?
Well, my parents were hippies. So
there we go. Hit the nail on the head.
All right.
They encouraged the hippie school.
Mm-hmm.
And once I got to the hippie school, they encouraged going out and finding yourself in the greater world.
Okay.
So I moved to Egypt.
Wow. That's always the first place I think when I'm like, wow, what am I going to do with myself? Egypt. It's a good choice, though. It's a pretty deep place.
Well, because I thought if I need to work on a language mm-hmm. that's going to make me a good reporter, why not Arabic?
Right, of course.
And has that not paid off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, obviously it has. How many different types of Arabic do you speak?
I speak the dialect that's spoken in Lebanon and Syria.
Okay.
There's a dialect unto itself.
There are a lot of dialects?
There are. There's Egyptian, there's Gulf dialect, there's Iraqi, and they all sound very different.
Okay. So now, what are some of, like, because I have no idea, you know, because this book is about Iran. I have really no idea how people live. I mean, I'm not completely narrow-minded, but I just don't know. What are some of the misconceptions we have about life in Iran?
I think the first misconception is that Iranian society is extremely religious, that everyone is covered in black all the time, and it's shrouded, and is like Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia,
mm-hmm.
that kind of you can't drive, you can't go to the bank sort of society.
They're not?
No,
oh,
actually.
Okay.
Really?
Yes.
What is it like?
It's in stark contrast to those other places.
Yeah.
You can wear, I mean, starting from the outside, you can wear color. You can choose what you want to wear, even though it sort of needs to be modest at the
uh-huh.
same time. Women work, and they drive, and they make movies, and have parties, and date, and socialize, and they have pretty much what we consider what young people do here, just with a little bit of difference in style around the edges.
So there is a secular aspect to Iranian culture, I guess, that we don't really hear a great deal about here. Because here, we have been under the impression that since the revolution in 1979, that all these things had been cracked down on. That women in particular, were subject to very harsh kinds of dress codes. We hear stories about the same kinds of things that are going on in Afghanistan, where women who don't cover themselves end up being physically attacked. That really wasn't happening on a widespread basis in Iran.
After the revolution, for about 15 years, until even longer, until the mid-90s, that kind of excessive, very brutal, repressive way of dealing with women was, you know, the norm for how the country was run. But after 97, we had the election of a more liberal, moderate president, President Khatami. And after 97, things changed very dramatically in Iran.
Okay.
And so social restrictions relaxed. You know, it made a difference in the way young people lived their daily lives.
Did they relax just culturally, or actually they actually relaxed on a government level?
On a government level, it was sort of a back and forth.
Okay.
You had more permits for more newspapers, so suddenly the press was more independent. But then that got rolled back. So it was sort of a loosening at the government level, but not a permanent one.
Now, as these reforms began to take place in the mid-1990s, did they have any effect on how Iranians looked at the regime of the Shah? The Pahlavi family was very much about, you know, westernizing certain modes of dress and that sort of thing. Did the view of the Pahlavis change as these reforms were put in place?
I think, yes, absolutely. There was a great nostalgia for the Pahlavi era and the pre-79 world of Iran. Not for its decadence, because people always felt really disgusted by its decadence.
Okay.
Because people were poor, and they were very obviously very rich.
Right.
But at the same time, they were nationalist enough and kept the country running enough that, you know, owning a house and driving on the freeway and all these things that you expect your government to take care of for you were going okay.
Mm-hmm.
So people were nostalgic and are nostalgic, I think, for a government that took care of the basics.
Okay. So now what about young people's view now in contemporary Iran? How do they feel about what's going on, you know, globally, politically? What do they think of Bush? What do they think about the sort of the press that there's an imminent attack?
I think that the notion that they're being talked about all of the time
mm-hmm.
by the president, you know, between the president and Europe, is very exciting because for years, and even in the reform period, it seemed like nothing would change and that everything was stagnant and would stay that way forever.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they're suspicious and ambivalent about what President Bush might want to do with Iran,
mm-hmm.
the idea that there is some sort of pressure that might be a catalyst for some kind of change that wouldn't have happened otherwise, I think is appealing. But,
yeah.
I mean, there's ambivalence there, too.
Is there fear?
There's definitely fear of the possibility of military strikes, because then you just might have the country in upheaval and everyone sees what Iraq is like to the left and is terrified that the same thing could happen.
I imagine that'd be amazing, amazing amount of fear. Can we talk a little bit about that region when we come back? Good. We're going to take a break. We're talking to Azadeh Moaveni. The book is Lipstick Jihad, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America and American in Iran. And we'll be back to talk about the current situation in Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. It's 45 past the hour, Air America Radio.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your vlog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Land this thing. It's 50 past the hour. Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Yep.
The show is Morning Sedition. We're talking to Azadeh Moaveni. The book is Lipstick Jihad, a memoir of growing up Iranian in America and America and American in Iran. And we're talking on the break. She lives in Beirut, and we're just talking. She was just saying what a party town Beirut is. Who knew that? I have no idea. What world am I living in? I think, like, you know, oh my God, look out.
No,
it's a party town.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, we're not telling anyone because we want to keep it a very exclusive party.
Everybody go to Beirut for the weekend.
I want to ask you one question about Iran. Because we are told here in the States that it is an article of faith that the Iranian people, for reasons having a lot to do with pride, are into this whole nuclear technology thing. And that they are prepared to defy the United States to buy the technology from wherever they can get it because it is a matter of national pride. Is that true among the younger Iranians?
I think young Iranians are evenly split. I don't think you could generalize and say young Iranians want the bomb and back their country or back the regime in having the bomb. A lot of them are really suspicious because the regime is often inefficient and they think there could be a Chernobyl.
Whoa.
Perhaps we prefer not to have them have the bomb.
So, they have some of the same fears we do.
Yeah.
Obviously. Now, in Beirut, there was some bad stuff went down. You know, the former Lebanese Prime Minister, Hariri, was assassinated. You interviewed him. What kind of man was he? And also, who is it assumed, who were people on the street thinking took him out?
He was a self-made billionaire in mm-hmm. construction, made billions in Saudi Arabia. And brought those billions back and used them to rebuild Lebanon after the Civil War.
Did he work with bin Laden?
No, I don't think
the bin Laden family, the construction family?
As far as I know, I don't think that he did.
Okay.
Although.
Maybe.
You never know.
The only reason I ask is because I know the bin Laden family made their fortune on construction in Saudi
Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, sure.
It's not essential to what we're talking about. But why was he, from where you're standing there, why was he killed and who was the guilty party, do you believe?
I will just share with you what Lebanese people, seem to think, and that's that Syria, the neighbor and quasi-occupier of Lebanon,
mm-hmm.
Might stood to gain from Hariri being assassinated, because mm-hmm. the pressure was high. He was sort of standing between the U.S. and Syria, but helping put pressure on the Syrians. Mm-hmm. You know, he was the glue that was holding Lebanon together. And taking him out was just a sign with this huge bombing that, you know, everything's not going to go this way.
Right.
How now the Lebanese government that was very pro-Syria has essentially resigned. Who do you think's next? Will the government that replaces this one in Lebanon be as friendly towards Syria, or are we looking at a more independent Lebanon, and will there be additional pressure to get the Syrian troops, what, 15,000 in the country, to get them out?
I think the Lebanese opposition has a very strong list of demands. Getting the troops out is one of them, definitely. I think we might see movement on that. But will the new government be much more independent? I think it's hard to call right now. I mean, clearly you'll have a coalition put together. It might include, for the sake of stability, some people who are closer to the Syrians, but a much wider number of people who are Lebanese opposition, Lebanese moderates, so you don't have this, you know, across-the-board spectrum of loyal Syrians in the government.
What effect is the the coerced democratization of Iraq having on these other countries in terms of how they see the idea of democracy?
I don't know if they've taken it two steps forward yet.
Sure.
First they say, or the first it seems to me that they think, wow, old orders can fall. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole reason that we've been apathetic all of our lives doesn't really exist anymore. So maybe my country or the place, whether I'm an Egyptian or a Syrian or a Lebanese, something could change.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing in Iran. But whether that means, you know, how will we come and put a democracy in its place that's independent and not beholden to President Bush, you know, it's not as clear.
So they see that, like, you're saying that things could change in terms of, like, perhaps the Americans can come and destroy our entire infrastructure and dismantle our entire country and force a democracy on us, but they don't think much in terms of, you know, how can we make a democracy ourselves?
If they knew how to make a democracy themselves, they would have done it.
You think?
Definitely.
Okay.
So,
what do you think of Jafari? You've talked to Jafari, the man who will likely be Iraq's prime minister. What kind of guy is he?
I think in the spectrum of these Islamist Iraqi politicians.
Is he an Islamist?
He is.
Okay.
I think we have to admit that he is. He comes from a group that has been, its whole identity is very Islamist and conservative.
Mm-hmm.
But I think he's a pragmatist. You know, I don't think he wants to make a theocratic Iraq that looks like Iran. He has allies with others. His relationship with Iran is much cleaner, I would say, than some of the other Shiite exile groups. So I think he's someone that could be dealt with, if only because, you know, his alliances are spread out enough that he's not going to take his agenda forward.
Well, great. Well, thanks for being with us. It was great talking to you.
It was.
Azadeh Moaveni, good luck with the book. You're going to be reading tomorrow night at the Barnes & Noble in Astor Place at 7 o'clock. Lipstick Jihad is a book, and it was great talking to you.
It really was. Thank you.
Okay, so where's the – there it is. There's the fax machine for the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders for today, liberal soldiers. Write these down. One, support public displays of the Ten Commandments only if they're displayed next to a stone tablet of Ginsburg's howl. Two, write to HBO. Tell them you'll gladly pay $10 more a month for really dirty shows. Anti-religious, $20. Three, it's Drug and Alcohol Awareness Week. Remember, it's anti-drugs and alcohol. Anti. All right. Four, praise the ACLU for suing Donald Rumsfeld over prison abuse. Then remind them that it's okay to win a case once in a while, too. Five, today's phrase, just drop this in the conversation. The bird flu is coming, man, from Vietnam. Agent Orange, My Lai, the Christmas bombing of Cambodia. Connect the dots, sheeple. Welcome to your government-sponsored plague. Wake up. All right, that's it, Riley.
That's it.
What do we got tomorrow?
Tomorrow, good friend Michael Tomasky is going to be on from the American Prospect. We're going to talk about the gap between Republicans and Democrats tomorrow on Air America Radio. Have a good one, Marin.
You too, Riley.